number one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
And today is Friday, the 21st of October, in the glorious future year of 2022. And I'm perhaps a little slow today, but last time I read from what you might call an ephemeral book about space travel. And I have a number of these ephemeral books. So, mostly little paperbacks that appeared in the late 1950s, early 1960s, when there was a great excitement about spaceflight. We have, let's see, the Signet Key edition of Flight into Space by J.N. Leonard, published by the New American Library. Sorry, some of these books have some lint accumulated on them, which is less a function of not having been opened in a while, and it is the fact that things around me attract lint. There's three volumes here by Vili Leigh. One is Satellites, Rockets, and Outer Space, newly revised with full-color illustrations. And it does indeed have full-color plates in it. Vili Leigh's For Your Information, On Earth and in the Sky, which is a collection of columns from Galaxy magazine, and Vili Leigh's Events in Space. I know someone who says he'll never forgive the universe for the fact that Vili Leigh, one of the great science popularizers, as well as one of the pioneers of the German Rocket Society in the late 20s, early 30s, died on his way to the Apollo 11 launch. In fact, I'll read you the foreword from Events in Space, which has on the cover, by America's most distinguished historian of the space age. Since World War II, Vili Leigh has been increasingly recognized as a leading historian and archivist in the field of rocketry and space flight, both in this country and abroad. Such he is to the thousands of readers of his books, columns, and articles. For those of us who have worked professionally in those fields, he is more than that. He is the reference source on the history of our profession. This recognition is borne out by the award of honorary fellow membership by U.S., British, and German astronautical societies and election to the International Academy of Astronautics. It seems to me there are three reasons for Vili Leigh's preeminence. One is the startling depth of his documentary research, stretching back 40 years to the great libraries of Berlin and elsewhere in Europe. Another reason is that Leigh was himself one of the organizers of German rocketry, sharing in the excitement, triumphs, frustrations, and despair of experimental tests in the late 1920s and early 1930s. Finally, and particularly important to the reader, Vili Leigh is a great storyteller. He tells it like it was and is, clearly and with wit and humor. In this book, the story of artificial satellites is engagingly told, how they evolved, who contributed to the technology and how, and the manner in which the stage was set for the traumatic impact of the first Sputnik nearly 12 years ago. The application satellites, first useful tools of the space age, are already at work serving man. Much more capable, sophisticated satellites are soon to be launched. The manned space station will become a reality in the next few years. Vili Leigh points out the international quality of new ideas again and again, proving that no single nation has an exclusive patent on originality. The careful log of all known satellites launched from 1957 to 1969 is an important and useful reference. The glossaries of satellite and rocket names are a boon to all of us who simply cannot remember the dozens of the changing project names and the original purpose of the programs. Vili Leigh assembles the cast of characters, major and minor, who have had their moment on stage in prologue or the present. The next act will be even more exciting. F.C. Durant III, National Air and Space Museum, Washington, D.C., 15 April 1969. His first chapter is a explanation of what artificial satellites are and how we got to this point. Hermann Oberth's Die Rakete zu den Planetenräumen. But yes. I have quite a number of these, what you might call ephemeral works on space travel. And one of the earliest by publication date. I mean, maybe I'm a little too harsh on them, but many of these are sort of journalistic books reporting the what's going on right now, rather than books like by the folks of the British Interplanetary Society or what have you, you know, discussing possibilities. But yes. Flight into Space, The Facts, Fancies, and Philosophy by Jonathan Norton Leonard. Copyright 1953, and he was a journalist himself. Let me read the first chapter of this here, which is quite short. The Earth is round and small, and there is little that man does not know about it. Really? But around the Earth lies the ocean of space, a highway to other worlds. When will man travel this highway which leads beyond the stars? Will it be soon, or eventually, or never? I'll point out that in 1953, the existence of tectonic plates and the movement of the continents was not yet scientifically established. In fact, that really only came with satellite geodesy, which was able to measure how rapidly the continents were moving and in what direction. The kids have already blasted off. They can buy spacesuits and one-kid rockets at almost any toy store. The heroes of the comics are fighting bad men on Mars. The subtler heroes of science fiction have pushed their operations beyond the Milky Way. Space has become the wild frontier of the modern imagination. To those who find the Earth too well-known, too tame, too dull, it offers unbounded adventure. To those who have faith in man and mind, it is a chance for the greatest achievement of the human race since the start of its history. Not only the kids, storytellers, and crackpots have turned their hope towards space. Serious scientists are devoting their time to the details of space flight and space inhabitation. Astronomers dream about the wonderful things that they could do with unhampered telescopes floating above the Earth's atmosphere. Biologists dream of finding and studying strange kinds of life on planets with novel atmospheres. In every great laboratory, every university, every proving ground of aircraft or guided missiles are men who give part of their thinking time to the glittering, many-faceted challenge that stares at them from space. A lot of this stuff is wishful thinking, juvenile or adult. Some of it is intellectual capering by scholars who like to play difficult games. But below this froth is a solid stratum of facts and probable theory. Man's headlong technical development is moving towards space. For more than 10 years now, his rockets have soared above the atmosphere. Each year, behind the blackout of military secrecy, they fly a little more surely. If the present rate of progress keeps up, which it may or may not do, manned space flight... Manned space flight will be a real possibility. This book will attempt to separate some of the facts of space flight from some of the theories and fictions. It will take account of three levels. The first concerns the accomplishments and attitudes of the men who design, build, and fly modern rockets up to the boundaries of space. This is an exciting subject, and it would be exciting even if it did not have a great objective in its future. It is a difficult subject to deal with because all work on rockets is also work on military guided missiles, and is therefore jealously guarded by the world's governments. I want you to remember, this was written only 9 years before Gagarin went into orbit. The second level is theory. A scientific campaign does not advance with a solid front. It pushes ahead at some points and lags at others. It develops elaborate plans to take enemy strongholds which lie, for the present, far beyond its reach. It trains its troops to use weapons that have not been constructed or perhaps not even imagined. It is not discouraged by any lack that may be corrected later. Space enthusiasts like to compare the present period with the era just before Columbus, when Europeans were about to vault the Atlantic. The comparison is not exact. Columbus did not know what he would find across the ocean, but he did have ships that would take him there. The spacemen know a great deal about what lies beyond the atmosphere, but at present they have no effective ships. They are like a Columbus who can see from the mountains of Spain the continents of North and South America, but who has only a rowboat to carry him across the Atlantic. While waiting for their space rowboats to develop into space caravels, the spacemen have elaborated an enormous body of theory to guide their future campaigns. Some of it is exact and needs no further improvement. Other parts are still soft but are gaining substance continually. Other parts are only misty outlines waiting for information that still lies beyond man's reach. This book will examine some of these theories and try to assay their content of fact. The third level is imagination, the very mixed bag of solemn or playful dreaming that may be called space fiction. Much of it is worthless. Wild West stuff transferred for the sake of modernity to the surfaces of distant or non-existent planets. You won't read it in Galaxy. But some of it has a kind of vision, and its popularity, which increases continuously, is proof that spaceflight has become one of man's great dreams. Space fiction is the modern equivalent of the traveler's tales that entertained Europeans before they could send their coast-bound ships beyond the encircling ocean. In those days, travelers returned from their dangerous journeys, which were often imaginary journeys, with stories of men who stood on one leg or who had heads like dogs, or tales of birds that could carry off full-grown oxen, or of whirlpools in the sea, or of happy races of men who lived without pain or hunger. Such tales were a lure that drew real travelers into the real unknown. In the same way, space fiction now leads modern men to think about the mysteries, perils, and marvels that surround the Earth. Behind the techniques and projects of spaceflight lies the haunting and rather frightening thought that man's move into space may be the next great step that has been assigned to evolving life. Man is new on the planet Earth, and civilized man who cooperates socially and accumulates knowledge has existed for only a hair-thin sliver of geological time. Scientific man is still newer, and fully technological man has been functioning in only a few places for less than a century. But already man has changed the appearance of his planet. Forests and prairies have turned into plowed lands. Deserts have turned green. Man's industrial fires and engine exhausts are speeding up the carbon cycle on which all plant and animal life depends. The night glow of man's cities and the flash of his atom bombs are conspicuous far out in space. The planet Earth is stirring. Man's intelligence has already become a geological force. Barring catastrophes and self-destruction, man may yet expand beyond the boundaries of the Earth. Then life, which began in the sea and pioneered the hostile land, may move into even more difficult space and thrive there enormously as it throve on the land. When this happens, man's intelligence will have become an astronomical force. There is much overlapping among the levels of space flight. The most solid achievement of the practical rocket men have an unreal quality that makes them hard to believe even when witnessed direct, and the wildest theories and fancies of the space travel enthusiasts often contain a trace of cold reality. It is hard to judge at this fast-changing stage which apparent facts are fancies and which apparent fancies are really embryonic facts. To make sure of one set of dreamlike facts, let us start with White Sands Proving Ground, New Mexico, that extremely romantic place where actual rockets with tails of flame fly into the blue sky. This is described on the back jacket as a clear, colorful, and authoritative book by the science editor of Time magazine. So. Chapter 2, Sacrifice at White Sands. A rocket shoot at White Sands Proving Ground is more than interesting, more than beautiful, more than exciting. It is inspiring in a way that is equaled by few sights on Earth. Behind the austere buildings of the military post rise the spectacular Organ Mountains, with a fringe of dark pine trees climbing to their highest ridges. An uninhabited wilderness presses from all sides upon this isolated outpost of technological man. Jackrabbits bounce among the cactus and yucca, deer dance down from the mountains at night and browse on the post's garbage, and sometimes mountain lions follow to browse on the deer. In front for 40 miles sweeps the gray-green desert of the Tularosa Basin. Dust devils swirl across it like yellow tornadoes, and sometimes great sandstorms blot out the sun. But much of the time the air is as clear as a vacuum, showing a rim of distant mountains around the flat desert floor. A person standing in the center, beyond where the rockets fly, can easily imagine himself in one of the moon's great craters, with the jagged ramparts circling around the horizon. The works of man seen from a distance look small in this great setting, but some of them are startling when seen from close by. On a steep mountain slope perches a massive concrete structure that has the soaring aloofness of a Tibetan monastery. This is a test stand, where the biggest rocket motors are put through their flaming paces. This is a test stand where the biggest rocket motors are put through their flaming paces. It really looks like an adjunct for a flight to the moon. Far out in the desert stands an even weirder structure, a peaked concrete igloo with walls and roof as solid as the stone of a pyramid. This blockhouse has narrow slits for windows, with glass many inches thick. Its strength is a prudent precaution against the possibility that a rebellious rocket may turn on its creators and rend them to smoking shreds. Near this modern donjon keep gather strange auxiliaries, tomb-like underground storage places for violent chemical fuels, lacy steelwork towers, a forest of poles and a spiderweb of wires. The desert for miles around is dotted with grotesque instruments. Radars sweep the sky with their pulsed electronic beams. The wide glassy eyes of cameras and theodolites stare at the launching sites. Far off in the mountain rim, great telescopes with 40-inch mirrors wait to follow the rockets on their flights into space. There are ghosts in this desert, too. The hollows between the mesquite hummocks, close to the launching site, are sprinkled with fragments of brilliantly painted pottery. Long ago, when the Tularosa Basin was a fertile valley, it supported a dense population of Indians, whose burial grounds and building foundations can still be traced among the thorny scrub. No one knows what happened to these ancient people. Perhaps the climate grew drier, perhaps some river changed its course or sank into the sand. At any rate, they are gone. They lacked the knowledge and resourcefulness to deal with such changes of environment. They left their dead and their pottery shards and the flint fragments of their poor, weak weapons. Amateur archaeologists from the Proving Ground sometimes dig in the sand close to the launching site and find their crouched skeletons, each with a painted pot inverted over its skull. Perhaps these departed people watch from under the pots that cover their heads as the rockets roar into the sky, but their ghosts do not bother the rocket men who live in the hard, taut world of the confident present. They are too busy with their intricate jobs to worry about the failure of their predecessors on the desert. J.N. Leonard here has some very definite literary sensibilities, for better or worse. On the day of a major shoot, the whole great apparatus spreading over the desert for hundreds of miles springs into tense activity. From the metal throats of invisible loudspeakers comes a slow, throbbing sound. This is a half-second beat that binds all activities to the grid of time. Jeeps and trucks scurry across the desert, raising feathers of dust. The non-human eyes of the radars swing toward the launching site, where men swarm over the steel framework that surrounds the beautiful shape of the readied rocket. Some of the rocket's attendants are muffled from head to foot like Arabian women in enveloping plastic garments to protect their skins from corrosive chemicals. Others wear earphones or carry walkie-talkie radios. They pump the rocket full of fuel, quiz its electronic brains, probe its valves and pumps with sensitive instruments. They are like midget masseurs grooming a tall and graceful ballerina for her first and last appearance on the stage of a great auditorium. Inside the massive blockhouse, which feels part like a mine, part like a radio station, part like the bridge of a battleship going into action, is a hum of tense activity and purposeful running around. Each man has a special duty, usually connected in some electronic way with the web of instruments spread over the desert. Squawking voices speak tersely with metallic tongues. Vivid green lines zigzag across the faces of oscilloscopes. On a long control panel under a slit window glows a line of little red lights. When one of them goes out, it means that some circuit is completed, some instrument far away has declared itself alert and ready. The half-second beat throbs on like a steady pulse. Then a solemn echoing voice comes over the loudspeaker. It says, 0-30 minutes. This means that 30 minutes remain before the hour, the minute, and the second when the rocket will fly. The men in the blockhouse, climbing over the rocket or watching across the desert, become a little more tense. Their blood runs a little faster. The moment is coming. The little red lights on the console panel wink out one by one. Voices report trouble, then trouble overcome. 0-20 minutes, chants the loudspeaker. Trucks and jeeps loaded with men dart away from the danger area. Gates are being closed. Chains are being drawn taut across distant highways. The men on the framework around the rocket are administering to it a kind of extreme unction. They check its intricate instruments for the last time and close the flush-fitting doors that cover access ports. They climb down reluctantly, and the steel framework is wheeled away, revealing the graceful shape of the doomed rocket. At this moment of unveiling, it looks like the most beautiful thing that has ever been built by man. 0-10 minutes, chants the loudspeaker. Now a solemn hush spreads across the desert. No men are in sight. They have all fled away, or gone inside the blockhouses, like ants going underground ahead of an approaching shower. Only a few red lights still show on the control panel. Scientists who have worked for years on the rocket's burden of instruments are muttering over and over their profane technological prayers. Some of them finger incongruous rabbit's feet. Others keep their fingers crossed like children in primary school. 0-1 minute, chants the loudspeaker. Now, the impersonal voice of the unseen microphone shares the growing excitement. 0-45 seconds, it chants in a higher key. Then, 0-30 seconds. The last of the little red lights is gone from the control panel, leaving nothing between the rocket and its moment of glory,